So, those of you, hopefully not too many of you, were at IFLA. If you were, you can do your email for the next 15 minutes, 20 minutes. I'm going to sort of fly high and give an overview of what we've been up to in Toronto with mass digitization over the last, it's getting close to 5 years now. And then Sean's going to do the interesting part and get down in the submarine and go into the details and the nitty-gritty. So save all your hard questions for her. Hopefully we'll have time for questions. Otherwise, we'll both stick around afterwards and we can talk to you individually. So let's get going here. So U of T has by far the largest mass digitization site in Canada. And this is one of the Internet Archive sites, the largest surviving, after Microsoft's pullout, the largest surviving Internet Archive site with these what are called scribe scanning stations. It costs us about 10 cents US per image. To make that viable, we have to scan at least 500 pages an hour. Normally, we end up doing more than that. We have 23 of these machines up on the seventh floor of Robarts Library in Toronto, working 14 hours a day, two shifts of 7 hours, 5 days a week. So you see the numbers there. We end up doing over 150,000, 160,000 pages per day on these 23 scribes, well over 100,000 books a year. So I'm just going to break my presentation now and give you a quick minute and a half video of the actual scanning center, because I can talk about all this, but actually seeing it hopefully will bring it closer to home. Just give me a sec here. Can you hear the sound at all? That's the sort of sound of the machine. So these individual pods, these scribes, the archive works much like an outside contractor here. We provide them the book flow. They hire and train the staff. They tend not to hire students. Student schedules make it too problematic to keep up the workflow. So these some of these people are actually, a few of them are actually volunteers, but mostly they're what they do all day long. Seem to think it's some sort of revolutionary thing, which it is. You'll see these, what happens is that we have, the books are on a 90-degree angle, and these supports have springs on them to relieve some of the pressure. The user can control those that pressure, because you have a glass platen that comes down to flatten the pages for the two cameras, which take simultaneous images of each side of the text block. So that's just about to end here. But that's... So that's your view of the largest mass digitizing center for the Internet Archive. That's what it looks like. It's a relatively confined space. Nope. So what I want to do is just talk about where we've been and where we're going. And where we're going is a constantly shifting thing. But basically, the archive came to Toronto in late 2004 to work on mass digitization. They realized that, and I'll talk about the archive in a minute, but they couldn't just pull in files from elsewhere. They're going to have to actually create digital content here if they wanted to get textual material onto archive.org. So we initially worked with Kirtos. Some of you know the Kirtos technology. Then the archive developed their own in-house technology. That was fully implemented in this phase two, which was a period where the Open Content Alliance, which I'll talk about in a few minutes, was formed when the Microsoft money came in. And then what I call phase three started when Microsoft money dried up on May 23rd, 2008. So you're probably all aware of the archive. It's best known, of course, for its Wayback Machine, 85 billion web pages indexed and rising. It's the brainchild of Brewster Kahle, who's trying to create a digital public commons. This is the picture there is their digital center in San Francisco with these petaboxes, as they're called. It's an amazing amount of storage here. That this slide, these figures were done about a month ago, and it's now, I don't know how many, it's 2.6 petabytes or 2.7 now. So to give you an idea, of course, that's well over a billion MP3 files. And I checked earlier today, they've actually dropped to about 440 on global sites, according to Alexa. They, of course, also are interested in other types of content. Audio, since last time I did the slide again, last month, they're now at 300,000 items and growing. Movies, moving images, they're now at 138,000 items and growing. In the last 4 weeks, it's been another 10,000. and text, well, Sean will talk a little bit about that later. So this first phase, you'll see the early version of the Kirtos machine there with the single camera on top and the vacuum arm that came across. This was a period where we experimented a bit with workflows and collections, drawing most of our material from the University of Toronto collections, and also some, interestingly, there at the bottom, some more recent material that was released, rights released by the University of Toronto Press. We did most ranges of Library of Congress. We focused on religion, history, Canadiana. This is phase two, some literature, science. There was always a battle here. There's always a battle with what the funding bodies, in this case Microsoft, wanted and what the library wanted. You know, we would have done old Canadiana first if we could have, being up in Toronto, but Microsoft, of course, we were one of many partners, and although we had, along with the California Digital Library, one of the two largest scanning centers, they're trying to share out the work. So they primarily in this phase also wanted English language. They were trying to populate their live book search, bring people to it, and in particularly in the U.S., they wanted things that would attract that audience. We had a little bit more leeway in Toronto since we were the one of the early partners, so we really did scan up and down the LC range and slip things in all the time that we wanted to do. I can say that now because they're no longer a partner. and there's no one from Microsoft here, I hope. Some special collections, although we really focused, if you're a 19th century or early 20th century scholar, this is like heaven on earth for you. We're still in the process of doing the easy stuff, and by that I would say the stuff on the open shelves, 1850 to 1922. We've been using the American definition of copyright. That's kind of debatable whether that's the right way to do it, but you're scanning in Canada, you're mounting on servers in the U.S., you're taking money from a U.S. corporation, so we just went along with that. Other partners like the British Library were at one point seriously considering not scanning anything past about 1850 because of concerns about British copyright, but we haven't really had any issues with the material that we've scanned, knock on wood. And to pause for a second, another interesting thing we did was create a script, actually. Sean, who created a script to identify materials that fell into this date range, pre-1923, on the open shelves, that were circulating from our collection. So creating these massive pick lists to scan is a task, and feeding the beast is a real task for 161,000 pages a day. And we created this script that would automatically identify materials that had circulated, had been returned, and they were sent automatically up to the scanning center on the assumption, of course, that if people were using them in print, they're going to want them digitally as well. We had lots of partners in the second phase, including the local one, McMaster. They actually came back to us twice, so we've done quite a bit more of their First World War collection. Focus just a moment on the Library and Archives of Canada and the Legislative Assembly of Ontario's library. There's a big push at right now in the third phase to think about government docs. We all have these collections in our libraries. What do we focus on next? Government docs being a big one. We partner with Public Library, Toronto Public. University of Alberta is currently scanning microfilms, Canadiana.org microfilms, and adding to this project as well. Tufts was another interesting model where Greg Crane, who's been involved with the Perseus project down at Tufts University, a classicist, had money through Mellon, wanted the capacity to scan materials, and classics in particular, but also some really obscure things. So we had the collection, so he paid for them, and we scanned them in our center, and they're out there on archive.org. And then lots of other partnerships. Individual faculty would come to us with their sort of recent imprints. They'd get the rights released from their publisher. We'd scan them if they wanted to use them for classes. And there are too many different instances to talk about right now. So just to reiterate with the archive, founded in 1996, started to work with the Million Books Project in 2003, and they started to get money in the U.S. They trialed with us. They ramped up to three sites, which was Toronto and two in California in 2006. And Microsoft came along. They started to build some more. Early 2008, they were up to 18 sites with a capacity to do about 300,000 books a year. Then along came May 23rd. And so now, it feels like we're all, just to be honest, we're scrambling a little bit. I think the center in Canada, the center in Toronto, is probably better off than the other Microsoft partners in the U.S., with a couple of exceptions. There are a couple of projects in the U.S. There's the Biodiversity Heritage Project, which is a consortium of different libraries wanting to digitize biology. Smithsonian's involved in quite a few other institutions, Harvard, others. And there's I think it's a Boston Library Consortium also. So there are some models there. And then here in Canada, we're in the province, actually across the country, we've been able to raise enough funds so far to keep the scanning center of 23 machines going probably through at least the end of the next calendar year. And like I say, things shift constantly. So I thought I'd just quickly transition here and just talk about, so we're in this next phase. We're not sure what it is yet. One model, of course, is Google Books. And I think there's a lot of positive things to say about Google Books, but there are limitations too. And we really, at least our view in Toronto, is we don't want Google to be the only show in town. Even their public domain things aren't open right now. It's hard to know some of what they're scanning. Is it old bitonal still? We don't know. It's a little bit of a black box, so we're not going to acquiesce to that. Microsoft Live, this is the thing they put up on May 23rd. So, the great thing about Microsoft was they helped us help the archive build the infrastructure. Microsoft probably invested a modest amount of money compared to the Google project, about $10 million, but they did. At the end of the project, they didn't have to, but they released any rights that they had negotiated with the libraries that are contributing. So these things all went completely into the public domain. Their little digital watermarks are being removed, so it's all public domain stuff. And the equipment that they paid for was given back to Kyrtos, to the Internet Archive. So there's capacity out there. It's just finding the right mixes of funding in different ways to keep this sort of project going. Open Content Alliance is really just a front for the Internet Archive in some ways, but they've just hired a new their first executive director. Their first meeting with that director of all the partners comes up in about a month. So this is something that was formed just before the Microsoft funding started, as an attempt to continue to help us, the libraries, museums, government organizations, and corporations collaborate to produce a truly open body of material, not just textual material, but also audiovisual material as well. Last time I gave this talk, John Henry Newman said in The Idea of the University came to my mind when I was on the slide. The aim of the university is a true enlargement of the mind, which is the power of viewing many things at once. And I think that's kind of the direction the Open Content Alliance is going. There's still this unrealized potential to work with and integrate all these different formats into one, and I think That's where that project is headed. Just to, out of interest, how many people have heard of this, Open Library? So, okay, more people than IFLA. This is a sort of a, you know, digitization 2.0. It's a web page for every book, Wikipedia-like. So that's an interesting project that's just really getting going. Again, sort of a spin-off of the activities of the Internet Archive. So just some thoughts and apologies to George Lucas. Don't tell him because I probably don't have the rights to use this photo. Why do we need a digital library? And actually, I was looking at this earlier. I thought, well, really the question is this where we're headed? I mean, how, you know, a single place where everything is, or is that even feasible, or is it something else? So now I think we've got this volume of material content, and we need to start seriously thinking about where the aggregated sites are going to be and what they're going to do. Things, of course, are changing. This professor, unfortunately, I don't have the after picture. This was a few years ago. He now works entirely online. So he's got a few files still, but it's nothing like this. And as we've been talking about through the day here, there are varieties of user experiences and preferences. I put the slide up just because what you see on the right, a university professor who works online, on the left, a undergraduate who doesn't work, you know, likes her physical books, and a very practical graduate student in the middle. So you can't, assumptions about what younger students are doing and sort of older faculty are doing are sort of blown out of the water, at least with the research that we've been doing at U of T. And we've been doing some user research, particularly in terms of how our users are using ebooks and what they want from them. And none of this comes as a shock. Their end goals are take priority. They heard about copyright, but they're going to do what it takes to get the content if they can. And they have an expectation that ebooks will function much like journals have. You get the PDF and the whole thing, not just bits of ebooks and whatnot. So these things are on our mind, and Sean will talk now a little bit about that, particularly on our mind since we're thinking about what we digitize through the archive and how it relates to what we also license, or the ebooks that we license.
Just the microphone for a shorter person. Am I audible? Okay. So what I wanted to do is just start off by talking about how the books come together in the library, in the mass digitization model, how you go about making that library. So what goes in? Well, books, of course. But because this is mass digitization, there are parameters on the books. They can't be too big and they can't be too small. But it's a pretty big bucket of just right. 3x3 is the smallest that we can handle, and 14.5x9.5 is the biggest. So it's a pretty fair range. The really big art books are a problem, but in the middle there, we've got lots of room for most kinds of books. Can't be too old and can't be too new. About 6% of the digitization stream gets rejected because it's had a hard life, basically. It's been rebound, it's been marked up, it's fragile, it just can't, you know, it's too close to the gutter. It's not going to go through the mass digitization queue. And of course, as Jonathan said, 1922 is our cutoff, so it has to be 1922 or older. So you've got your books, you've got your MARC metadata, obviously, so that you can find the thing once you've got it digitized. Now, I'm going to spend a little bit of time on this because this is actually a surprising gotcha. Z3950 is the mechanism that makes sense for grabbing the MARC data out of the OPAC. So when we send books to the scanner, we've got a truckload of books and we've got an OPAC sitting over there online. The people that prep the books, there's two of them. What they do is they pick up the book and they assign it a unique ID for the archive. And then they have to get the metadata via Z3950, book in hand. That's what they've got in hand. So we're going to come back to that in a minute. Because start thinking about what have you got in that book that's going to let you really fast grab the metadata from the OPAC? You don't want to be typing in titles, right? That's kind of slow. Two prep stations and 23 scanners. So they need to keep going. Once they've got the metadata out of the OPAC, I'll come back to that. They create a folder for the book with the book's ID on it. They scan the book. They bung all the images in the folder as camera raw. They perform quality assurance as they go. When they're happy with the thing, they release it for upload. It moves to the central station in San Francisco, where the derivatives get created, and we'll go through those in a minute. They approve the book for release, and then the book's available online. So that's sort of a really quick look at the workflow. Back to that thing about the ID. It actually is a big issue for the library because it can add a lot of work time sort of behind the scenes getting the books ready to go to the scanner. So your ideal book identifier has to be really easy to enter. Preferably, you want to be able to scan the thing. It's got to be unique, obviously, and so we're not talking titles or call numbers. It's got to be capable of retrieving a record via Z3950, so it's probably not a barcode. Most OPACs aren't going to think the barcode is something that's part of the MARC data. And it's actually got to be on the book. And this is a book that's 1922 or older, so it's not an OCLC number, it's not an LCCN, it's not an ISBN, it's not a DBCN, that's not on the book. None of those things are on the book. So what do you do? There's a few possible solutions. One, you can be lucky enough to have an ILS that thinks that barcodes actually are MARC data, in which case you're done. Scan the barcode and you've got your MARC record. We don't. You could put a flyer in the book that has an identifier. So have someone go through and print flyers that have identifiers that get you the MARC record somehow and stick a flyer in each book times several thousand books a day times 7 days a week times you. That's a significant workload. Or you can provide an intermediary script, some kind of a mechanism that says, okay, give me something that's on the book and I'll give you back an identifier that'll get the Z3950 record for you. And that's what we did. Whoops. There we are. So what we did, we just wrote a little script, scan in the barcode, we do a query of our ILS database, we grab an identifier that's in the MARC record, and we give that back to the Internet Archive staff so they can use that to grab the actual MARC record. The other thing we do at the same time is ask them what they're going to do with the book. Are you going to scan this thing? Are you going to reject it? Why are you going to reject it? And we use that to track what's happened to the book, so that's actually kind of a nice side effect for us. So that gives us the data for the next slide, which is what actually gets rejected. We've had 143,000 books go through the center so far. Of those, 12,000 odd have been rejected for reasons that it should never have gone there in the first place because it's in copyright or it's already been scanned. So I've pulled those out of the pool. So the major, major reasons why something's going to get rejected. And again, this is mass digitization. The whole idea is that we're doing this fast. If we need to do it slow, we're going to do it on some other scanner somewhere else. This thing only works if it's fast. That's what keeps it cheap. Foldouts are the biggie. 30% of the rejects have foldouts. There actually is a mechanism for dealing with those now. So that's sort of retrospectively looking back over the past several years of experience, 30% of the rejects were rejected because of foldouts. Now we can deal with them. We're happy about that. Others are basically, like I said, the book's had a hard life. The print runs into the gutter, the print's running into the margins, the thing's in fragile condition, it's not going to survive being scanned. They all get rejected. One of the reasons, 4% of the books get rejected because they have uncut pages. So these are books that have been sitting in our collection for the last 80 years and no one has ever read them. All right, so that's what goes in. What comes out? JPEG 2000 is what gets converted from the camera raw. And a JPEG 2000, we actually have the option of three formats there. Just raw JPEG 2000, which is as it was shot, not cropped, not deskewed, just as it came out. Those things are about 900 kilobytes each. The cropped, deskewed, and light compensated JPEG 2000s are about 800 kilobytes each per page. And optionally, you can ask for a watermarked JPEG 2000, about the same size. Then the use derivatives. PDF is the major one coming out. It's page images with embedded OCR. And they provide both color and black and white. The color are 100 kilobytes or so. Black and white, 60 kilobytes a page. So that sort of gives you the math to sort of start thinking about times 100,000 books times 300 pages. It adds up into the terabytes fairly fast. But that's sort of the, what do you actually keep locally? Do you just keep the derivatives? Do you keep the JPEG 2000s locally? How do you fund that is a question we grapple with. And there's a whole bunch of metadata. The MARC data is pulled out of your catalog. returned as an XML file. There's operational metadata, separate XML file that records who did the scanning, when they did it, and some basic data from the MARC record so that you can glue the two together. Then there's a structural metadata XML file. That's pretty minimal right now, and that's something where we'd like, I'll come back to that at the end. Right now we've just got pagination if it's in the book, if the page numbers are printed, the covers, the title page, the copyright page. But structural metadata, I think, is a real key to finding stuff in books a little bit more easily. And then there's the OCR, which is UTF-8 and positional, so that you can actually, you know, do the thing where you highlight the PDF image because of the OCR telling you where it is. And a flipbook. How many people have seen one of the Internet Archive's flipbooks? Okay. I think this is the nicest model for an online book. So I'm going to actually take us there now. Bear with me just a second and show it to you, because this is just such a nice way of presenting a book online. This is actually one of our top 10 downloads, and it's a book labeled Constructive Anatomy, spelled kind of like that, but not quite like that. All right, let's see what that does for us. Yeah, so I'm going to go take a look at the page here. It's a busy site. Sometimes if you hit it in the afternoon, it's a wee bit slower. Here we go. So this is what an archive page looks like, and here are all our derivatives down the left here. I'm going to open up the flipbook for us. So what this is straight up just a book on the screen. If you click on the right-hand side, the pages turn. If you click on the left-hand side, the pages turn. If you click halfway down the stack of pages, you flip through the book, and it will tell you where you're turning to. And if you want to find something particular, and you have the gift of being able to type, let's go looking for fingers. It will put little stickies in the book and show you where it is and give you text snippets. I love to show this. I think it's such a smart thing. I think it was a guy in Texas that actually did it, and it's open source. It just seems to take everything that we understand about using a physical book and move it online in a really sort of transparent kind of a way. I think it's such a clever design for an online book. Anyway. Oops. Okay. So you get flipbooks, if you can use them. So what I wanted to do now, sort of having talked through what we put in, what we get out, is how it actually gets used. So we've done all this stuff. Are people using it? Yeah, they are using it. Just for fun, I put up the top 10 downloads from U of T's collections, and it's a really diverse bunch of things. The top one is St. Augustine's De Civitate Dei. 64,000 downloads, way out in front, and we're not sure why. Do we know why? We don't know why. The next one is Constructive Anatomy, 13,000 odd downloads. It's a fairly diverse bunch of books. There's romances from the 16th century, 17th century, I believe, book about French torture instruments, some philosophy. We're back to a book about the plague. English book bindings, and Flatland is an interesting one because that's in the top 10 downloads off the Internet Archive site. It sits in a rare book room at St. Michael's College Library at the University of Toronto, where, to my knowledge, it hasn't been used at all. So that's quite a switch for Flatland. And the last thing, just to contrast with those torture instruments, is Florence Nightingale's book about nursing. So that's just for fun, but how heavily are these things used? Well, the top 100 books, the average number of downloads is 3,000 odd downloads for our top 100 books on the Internet Archive site, and the minimum number of downloads in that group is 1,500 odd. Even if we go down to the top 50,000 books, they've been used an average of 125 times each, and the minimum use is 61 downloads. If we go right down to the bottom of the list of those 140-odd thousand books, the bottom 38 have never been used. But I'd like to think that those guys were just put up in the last few days, so they really haven't had a chance yet. And if we take it out to the bottom 10,000, then we're starting to see that the average use is, I think I've got this backwards, the average use must be 11 and the minimum use 6. But it's still, there's a substantial use there. And I just wanted to contrast that to our print collections for this same pool of books. The top 100 books have been used, and this is going back considerably further because we've got, obviously, circulation stats going back some several years, and I'm going to embarrass myself because I can't remember quite how many, but it's in the 5 or 6 year range, even with the changing ILSs. 90 times is the average use in our top 100, and the minimum number of times any one of those has been used is 65. On the archive site, you have to go down to the top 50,000 to get down to that kind of number. So the use goes way up when we stick these things online. Now, this is, I'm sorry, it's late in the day, and this is an impossible slide to read. But what I wanted to do here was take a look at what have we scanned proportionally and what has been used proportionally. So the sort of burgundy-colored bars are, by LC class, the proportion of the collection that was scanned. And then the next two bars in each series, the yellow and the blue bars, are how many titles in the top 50,000 from that class were used. That's the yellow bar. And what was the proportion of downloads in the top 50,000? So more of a weighted measure for the blue bar. So if we see that the red bar is lower than the yellow and blue bars, then we've got something that's getting used more than we might expect it to be. And if we've got the red bar exceeding the yellow and blue bars, then we've got something where it's not getting used quite as much as we might expect it to be given the proportion that was actually scanned. And so what we're seeing there is that the higher use areas are the general knowledge area, A, philosophy and religion, big time, all of our history ranges, anthropology, geography, art, and library science, bibliography. Anyone guess why the C's got heavy use? Sort of the auxiliary science of history? Genealogists? Yeah. Always, everything we've ever digitized, the genealogists have been a wonderful, dedicated crew using it, and I'm sure that's why the C's got heavy use. Expected use, sort of a bunch of stuff in the middle, sciences, technology, music, what have we got there, political science and law. And lower use areas, social sciences, education, literature, that one interested me. It's quite a bit lower proportionately, and I speculate, surely uselessly, that it might be because that stuff's relatively easy to get hold of elsewhere. And the R's, medicine. I'm kind of relieved that medicine's, given that it's pre-1922, not getting used quite as much as it might. Okay, so so this is how we do it. When we've got the luxury of the books are sitting in stacks, which are in the same building by and large. The scanning unit is housed in our largest library. It's our Humanities and Social Sciences Library. The Internet Archive does scan for other libraries, and they like to scan for other libraries. What are the options for getting that done? Well, the first big category is ship the books. And if you ship the books, then you also need to get the metadata somehow. So there are three basic options there. Either send a file of MARC records, and we'll load them into our own OPAC, just in a shadowed location, so that we can grab them from there. Or we can arrange to request MARC records for your books from somewhere else, like LAC or LC or McMaster or U of T or wherever. And the third option is to just provide Z3950 access to your own OPAC. And the other model for actually getting stuff scanned is to sponsor books. And that's what the Tufts University Perseus collection was. What they said is, we really want this group of books scanned. We don't want to ship them up there. That's kind of expensive. You guys have got them. So we're going to sponsor them. Our name's going to go on the books. Pull them from your stacks and scan them, please. Absolutely fine. Not a problem. That's something. That's another model that works quite nicely. So that's, if you're thinking about scanning some of your own stuff, and that seems like an attractive model, that's a way to get it done. Obviously, there's this massive repository of books out there that can simply be accessed as well. And the most direct way to do it is just to put in a link to the Internet Archive. It's a million books, then, that you're providing online access to. You can add MARC records for those books to your own catalog. They absolutely welcome that. They need to drive up the use, so that's a good thing to do. And then you've got the metadata created, sort of integrated with your own local collection. And the third option is just to add full-text books. If you've got a local repository, add those. And that third option is the one that would actually enable you to provide full-text searching of the books, because that option isn't available through the archive currently. So what are we going to do with it? First of all, Scholars Portal, which is the OCL-sponsored initiative, is building an ebook platform, which we hope to have up and running in March 2009, I believe. And that will house both licensed and free content. So all of the Internet Archive content is coming home, and it's a local platform. We're building it on ISIS, which is eBrary's software, essentially. It's not housed at eBrary. It's not the eBrary interface. It is eBrary that's providing the software to house the local books. It's a PDF-like reader, so it's got the sort of things you might expect in a sort of a book platform. It looks like you're reading a PDF. You've got the ability to bookmark, to have a bookshelf, to annotate, to search. And all of the Open Content Alliance, all of our Internet Archive material will be freely available through that platform, so that it'll be a place where people can come and search the full text if they want to. I was listening with interest to Steve's comments about the BiblioCommons and the plans for their catalog. They resonated with me. We're in the process of building a faceted search engine. It happens that we're using Indeca, which is the same software that NCSU and Florida and Phoenix have used as well. And we're sort of really thinking about taking the word catalog and stretching it a bit to mean more than we currently mean by it now. So we want to load metadata for all books that happen to exist in print, out of print, not just our books. Just give people an easy way to filter down to our books so they can verify if something exists from that catalog. Obviously, the website we need to integrate, articles and indexes, abstracting services, ANIs, full text journals and full text books. So that'll give people the ability to sort of have the one-stop shopping and search whatever they want to find in the catalog. And that's just a screenshot of the Indeca interface with the facets going down the left. I haven't really thought of anything useful to say about that slide, so it's the discovery layer. On we go. So I just wanted to wind up by saying a little bit about what we plan to do next with all of this. Print on demand is a biggie for us. There's all that research out there that says that particularly for these kinds of books, for old books, for things that are in the humanities, people do not want to read them on a screen. They want to be able to print the things and read them comfortably. That for that sort of intent of reading, they need to have a paper copy of the thing for cognitive reasons as well as for comfort reasons. So print on demand is a biggie, and we're in discussion with various people about that, and the Internet Archive is too. So we're hoping that that will be a service that's available both locally and at the archive soon. Scan on demand. If we haven't got around to scanning the thing yet and it meets our parameters, like it's out of copyright, then we'll put a button in the catalog that lets people request the thing get scanned. We're also looking at enriched structural metadata to improve the discovery of these things, because right now we've got these skinny little MARC records, and for these older things, they really are skinny little MARC records, and that's basically it or the full text. So how do we beef up the places where people can go to find out more about the books? The current structural metadata, like I said, is the pagination, the covers, the title page, and the copyright page. That's a good start, but we'd really like to add the table of contents and the index at the back of the book, and any images and maps that are in the books, because those are things that people are quite often looking for. And here it becomes a sort of an economical game. I was just doing the math and making sure I had it right. It's 43 million pages so far that we've got in our 140,000 books. And if, as is often the case, the software that adds the structural metadata is on a per-page charge, then 43 million pages gets to be kind of scary. So it has to be done in a focused way. We either zone which chunks of the book we're applying the metadata to, or we focus in on the collections that we know are really heavily getting used, or we get people to do it voluntarily. That'd be a good trick. But there's got to be some way of adding that metadata that we need in those books in a fairly creative and structured way. So those are our next plans, and that sort of brings us to the end of what we had to tell you. And we'd welcome any questions that you have for us now.